a certain form of meditation becomes necessary if one is going to take certain initiations and experience and process the speeded up karma and the other kinds of experiences and the turmoil that these initiations bring. This kind of meditation we call higher triad meditation. Higher triad meditation is similar to certain forms of contemplation, to Mahamudra or Dzogchen meditations in Tibetan Buddhism. And it is similar to what the Master Jesus taught his disciples, his apostles. And this form of meditation is a communion. It has been said that if prayer is talking to the higher worlds or communicating from oneself up into the higher worlds, then meditation is listening to the higher worlds, attuning to the higher worlds, attuning and listening to higher guidance. And the kind of meditation that we need to learn to do in a temple is the kind that is that of listening. We call it higher triad meditation because it involves the upper group of the energy centers of the body, beginning with the heart chakra, the heart, throat, the ajna, and the crown, and that portion which is called the chalice. This form of meditation is the kind of meditation that is done in the higher worlds by higher beings who are our guides and by their guides who are in even higher planes of reality and as remote from them as our spiritual guides are from us and by theirs in turn. And it is this kind of attunement that allows the workers and servers of all planes and all levels to align and attune at certain special times like full moon meditations and the Shambhala moons and other great times of cosmic communion. Not everyone has the same kind of a mind, and not everyone approaches meditation in the same way. Many people want to begin a meditation practice but feel unsuccessful when they try because they're discouraged by the fact that their minds wander and they don't feel any benefit from what they're doing. And they don't get the cosmic bliss that they are led to believe they should expect. Other people are practitioners of forms of meditation that involve the single-pointed focus of the mind on certain symbols or seed thoughts, on certain kinds of Kabbalistic or other, for example, Tibetan letters that symbolize certain energies and so on, or visualizations. The kind of meditation that we're involved with and that we need to adopt and become skilled in doing in the temple is not a visualization form of meditation, and it is not working with visualizations of symbols that represent certain kinds of divine energies. It's working with the divine energy itself, straight knowledge, face-to-face, without symbols, and without intermediaries. Higher triad meditation, then, is instant and divine communion with divine reality, which is all reality. Higher triad meditation is breaking through the veils and the limitations of the lower personal ego states in which we normally have to operate in order to see and view from the higher ego states that in many traditions are perceived as divine ego states that human beings cannot have and cannot participate in. If we can understand that that in us which says I and finally learns to say we, that in us which identifies as self and as ego, and I use it in the most expanded and highest sense, not just the psychological sense, is a successive unfolding of higher and more expanded selves that ultimately is the one self of the universe. Each of us is that in microcosm. And in meditation, we ascend the octaves and harmonics of ego state and self-consciousness to approach the one self, the one heart, the one being that we all are. And in that is the great esoteric fact that we is the proper method for prayer of any sort. One never approaches the divine with I this, I that, but we, as the Master Jesus taught us, our Father who art in heaven, and so on. We cannot think of ourselves in human terms as I when we are involved in high-end esoteric work. We have to expand the I to the we, and we have to see ourselves as part of a great orchestra, part of a great ensemble. Now, what is higher triad meditation? Well, like all meditation, it's an approach to self-knowledge that uses direct and subjective experience rather than objective experience and measurements as a means of revealing and integrated what are basically untapped creative and intuitional and psychic faculties. And it includes techniques that are effective in amplifying and fine-tuning all existing abilities or skills, as well as methods for psychological self-discovery and analysis and positive transformation. So it's kind of a high-tech approach to the systematic unfoldment of human potential. It must be a daily practice, or it doesn't work. You cannot meditate a little now and then a few weeks later again, and so on. And if it is done daily, it produces long-term cumulative results. And over the years, they result in deepenings, maturations, ripenings, and sequential unfoldments of expanded awareness and higher ego states and self-mastery in mental, emotional, and even physical life. Advanced meditators can often develop and demonstrate conscious control over basic cellular functions of their own physical bodies. Now, there's no reason to be intimidated by all the schools and paths and variations of meditation practice, because meditation is in countless varieties, because there are countless goals and aims of meditation, just as there are in the physical world countless goals and aims of all kinds of activities that are done in the external world. Meditation techniques are simply skillful means of achieving certain kinds of results, and there are all kinds of results that can be desired in the internal life and interior work. The point of this introduction is not to introduce us to the panoply and the huge field of meditation practices of all sorts, but rather to introduce us to the most basic, most elemental, and most direct form of illumination and higher communion that is possible for us to develop. Now, what are the results of higher triad meditation? The first thing is, after a persistent daily practice, and we only ask that you meditate 5 minutes a morning, that's all. You meditate after you awaken. You can go to the bathroom, but don't eat, don't talk to anybody, don't start using your brain for things, don't start worrying about things. Just wake up, get yourself comfortable biologically, and then sit. How do we sit? Well, a chair is the most common way in the Western civilization, and it is a good way for putting your spine perpendicular to the ground, which is the way it has to be, because that keeps you safe from invasion of other kinds of forces when you make yourself subjective, and it also promotes the evolutionary movement, the proper kind of movement of the interior energies and forces that are being worked at that time. We do not sit in direct sunlight, but we don't sit in the dark. We certainly don't sit in the dark with a flickering candlelight or something like this. We sit in indirect sunlight with our eyes closed. The easiest way to do this and the best results are with the eyes closed, but with a kind of field, a slight field of light that is visible through the thickness of the eyelids, so that one is not immersed in very black darkness, but a slight kind of light in the background. It's best to sit facing east. If we want to sit in eastern postures, the best thing for a Westerner who's not accustomed to doing those things then is to sit on some kind of cushion that must keep his or her thigh joints no lower than and preferably higher than the knee joints, because if the butt is down too low, the tremendous strain is introduced at the root chakra level and in the thigh and the hips, and it interferes with successful meditation. It's very important for the body to be relaxed and comfortable, because what we don't want to do is be constantly concerned about feeling uncomfortable or something getting numb or something hurting and having to be moved and so on. Now, it is most important to do this first thing in the morning, because that is the time when the mind can be most lucid before worries and thoughts and activities of the day come in, and it's the time when the highest contact can be made most easily. It's much harder to meditate during the middle of the day or when you're in the thick of your daily activities. It's fairly easy to meditate at sunset if you are in a relaxed state or after a meal, but then you have more dangers of falling asleep. So the best time to be able to be in a relaxed state with a clear mind without falling asleep is right after you awaken, when you're refreshed. And there are other reasons for that too. If it can be done at the time of sunrise, that is even better. There are reasons for that that I won't go into. Now, the first result of persistent daily meditation, which is done for only 5, 6, or 7 minutes, very short but very intense, is to, after several months, usually, to finally penetrate and finally break through the ground of what I call false, limited, normal mental consciousness, or the veil of the normal personal perceptions, into what might be called a vast and luminous nectar of awakened consciousness. Now, this breakthrough only occurs for perhaps a second or 2 seconds when it first comes, and it feels like falling asleep, because one just can't hold the energy and bring it back. But it's not a falling asleep, it's a falling awake. And when that happens, one will suddenly come to himself and think, oh my God, I was in a place of great light and great peace and great harmony. And once that contact is made, the veil has been rent, and it's easier to get to that point. And at that point, when that has been achieved, then the meditation should be persistently done each day until that state is achieved, if only for a second or 2 seconds. And eventually you'll be able to widen the rent in the veil, and you'll be able to hold it for 5 seconds or 8 seconds. And the whole goal of this kind of meditation is to achieve this and then hold yourself in that state. It's not in a state of brilliant, clashing light. It's in a state of soft clouds of illumination. It's a vast state because the consciousness is extremely expanded. And by consciousness, I don't mean mental perceptions of shape and so on, because the mind is the mechanism of the mind is very still and very calm. But by consciousness, I mean the feelings. I don't mean the emotions, but the feeling, the general kind of sensibility, is very expanded, and one is sitting in a position of great awakenedness and great awareness with great calm. And it's called luminous or enlightened because there is no longer a sense of void or of darkness or of emptiness. It is suddenly realized and understood and experienced that there is no void, there is no space that is not luminous, that everything is filled, everything is a plenum that is filled with a kind of light. And it is an experience of light, but a gentle kind of light. Many people call that the holy white light of Christ within. And it's like a nectar because it's very sweet and it's very harmonious, and it is a state that really cannot be described by words. Going into this state before beginning the work of the day does tremendous things, because the result is that as one then goes out into the battles of life for that day, one goes out in a much higher state of attunement and intelligence than one has normally. One keeps a cooler head, is able to function more effectively and realistically in crisis situations, able to concentrate, focus effort, visualize problems and solutions, to think on his feet, to tap into intuition and spontaneous helpful insights, to approach emotional problems and conflicts with less static and worry. And as one begins to develop this new higher ego state that one is carrying now into the daily life from this place of meditation, his or her mental faculties begin to clear and function in the moment with expanded awareness. And this effect might be described as a demonstrable gain in intelligence and mental and emotional and even physical self-mastery. Now, everything that a meditator achieves in meditation is a permanent asset. It isn't something that ends or something that can be lost or that you can get rusty at. You can get rusty at the skill of meditating, but what you gain in meditation is always with you. What you gain is an asset that becomes part of what is called the chalice, which is that center of your energy from your heart center and around into the higher triad and down a bit into the solar plexus that contains and accumulates nonverbal, non-three-dimensional, non-material essences and nectars and fragrances that are carried from lifetime to lifetime. So that every achievement that's made in meditation, every achievement of drawing closer to a conscious awareness of the higher reality and the higher worlds, every attainment that is made in attuning oneself is a building, a permanent building of the antakarana or the spirali and bridges that connect the different octaves of sense. If you look at the five human senses, taste and touch, which are close, taste and smell, which are closely related, sight and hearing and the tactile senses, those have higher forms in higher planes and higher bodies of existence that are normally invisible to people. The sense of sight becomes at a higher level clairvoyance, clear vision. The sense of hearing becomes at a higher level clairaudience. The sense of taste becomes at a higher level the sense of discrimination, and the sense of the olfactory sense at a higher level becomes the intuitive faculty, which is also linked partially with the solar plexus. And the tactile sensation at a higher level becomes the telemetric, psychometric ability to function. Because this is an interior kind of growth which activates and brings what was hitherto unconscious or subconscious or superconscious into the field of expanded consciousness, and it's therefore cumulative. And so although the meditator may ripen or complete and then leave some kind of specific practice or specific achievement, the effects it produces remain as foundation and building blocks for more advanced kinds of effects and practice, whether one continues to meditate or not. Thus, one can deepen practice or deepen achievements without losing anything. And after this sort of thing starts to be achieved, the meditator may become aware of living and looking out into the world from a higher, more advanced ego state, which at first is the ego state of we. It's the ego state of compassion, being able to feel the pain of other people and feel and see and understand things from the point of view of the other person in a much clearer way than ever before, in such a way that it becomes impossible to hate, impossible to desire to do harm to anyone. And as they say, love, the petals of the lotus begin to unfold. There are love petals and there are compassion petals and so on. And as this occurs, as the meditator becomes more sensitive and his definition of self becomes more expanded, so that when one says I, one means we, and when one says I, one means all the beings around oneself, and one can speak for and feel for and work for and do things for all beings, as the Oglala Sioux says when he does some kind of spiritual practice, oh, grandfather, I do this that my people may live. And we say, oh, Lord, what I do here is done for all humanity and for the planet and for all that is sentient and in form, rather than just for my little form and my little personality. As one becomes more and more aware of that, then one begins to make very clear contact with higher guidance that comes through intuitive flashes, and not usually through voices and visions, but through what we call straight knowledge, direct kind of knowing. When one is in the presence of another person, one begins to know what that other person's motives are. If someone's lying, that is just a sense that one already knows. It's not something one has to wonder about. One begins to see into the subtle realities of the people around him, and one also begins to understand the subtle causes of things and to therefore be able to deal with reality in the flesh and in this body and in this world more effectively. A refinement and extension of the five-sense reality results in more intense experiences and also results in more intense pain and more intense bliss. And as one begins to add octaves of capability to one's sensibilities and one's sensitivities, one can handle and deal with more pain as well as more bliss. And as the meditator is able to identify with and then integrate successively higher ego states towards the one great self, thou art we art thou, we are thou art I am thou, then meditation itself becomes continual without necessity of sitting. The time that one sits at meditation will stretch out. It will go from 5 minutes to 8 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. As one begins to hit pay dirt in the meditation over the first couple of months, and it isn't something that happens immediately, you just have to do it and do it and do it and do it. But eventually, as it starts to become a practice that you feel like you've really missed if for some reason one morning you have to do without it, and then one starts to hit pay dirt with it and finally begin to rend that veil and start to have this experience, then meditation becomes a sweet thing that one looks forward to. And one has to discipline oneself not to spend lots of time in it, because it's quite a reward and quite a payoff. And the corollary to that is that, however, one begins to achieve these states during on his feet, walking through life during the day. And as one is able to integrate this higher reality and these higher ego states, this becomes more and more a normal situation. As the Master Jesus said, the Sabbath is not one day a week, it's every day of the week. And all times are sacred and all places are sacred. And as one takes his or her place as a co-worker with the one self that is always beyond self and all ego states, then the meditator begins to yogically oversee what to most people are involuntary bodily functions, correcting illness and disharmonies in his own body and in other people's bodies, and enters into intimate dialogue with the treasury and profundity of subtle, invisible, and esoteric reality that's normally hidden from minds, and he works for the greater good of all other beings, which the meditator now begins to feel and empathize with as self. and finally makes telepathic and even physical contact with other highly developed brothers and sisters who themselves have these kinds of achievements, living in physical bodies or maybe out of bodies, that are doing similar but coordinated work under the same higher planetary guidance, the work of the elders and the great plan and the hierarchy, selflessly promoting the higher evolution of human consciousness in the various fields of human activity. And so this is kind of a very abbreviated summary of what the long-term effects of meditation are. How do we begin? Well, I have written this book based on the experiences I've had with many different people at the University of California who were just beginning meditation for 2 years when Marie Luminasar and I led the meditation fellowship. And we find that there are basically three kinds of mind. Just as one might say there are three ray types of personality. Those that are primarily tactile, those that are primarily visual, and those that are primarily auditory. The olfactory and taste senses relate very much to the tactile senses. And we find that if people will go through three meditation exercises on three successive days, you can't do it all the same day, and observe very carefully what they experience during those times of meditation, they will learn enough about how their own mind works to be able to formulate a successful strategy for meditation. And for some people, visualizing a certain thing helps. For some people, listening for a certain thing helps. For some people, other kinds of things help. And in this book, we suggest these three exercises. One is simply a tactile type of thing, and one is a visual kind of thing, and one is an auditory sort of thing. And then you analyze what your results are. What was distracting you each time? What kinds of things are distracting you? Are they sounds you keep hearing outside of yourself? Are they the sounds that are going on outside the building? Or are they the feeling your body's uncomfortable? Are they tactile things that distract you? Or are they visual things? Do you keep seeing things? Or do you keep thinking of the past or the future? Are you worrying about the future? Your mind keep going back to the past? You start to learn what the mindscape is that characterizes your particular personality. Now, of course, there are seven possible combinations of just two, and some people are auditory and tactile, and some people are visual and auditory. And then beyond that, there are even more combinations because many people have all three categories active in their minds and so on. But this will help a person to analyze exactly how his mind works and how his or her mind is distracted. And then you build upon the strength of the mind because you cannot work against the mind. You cannot stop up the mind and stop it from flowing. You cannot make the mind do one thing the way you want it to do. You have to use the energy and the direction of the mind and build upon its talents.